This hypersensitivity to threat and a tendency to interpret others as always harboring hostile intentions towards my own group. That's destructive.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. I'm your host, Tobias Sturson, and I'm the co-founder of Heart Management. The most common organizational culture challenge that we hear raised by our network of HR professionals and leaders is an us versus them mentality. Whether the issues stem from a merger of multiple organizations, an acquisition, or division between departments, we've heard so many stories of how it hampers collaboration, innovation, and effectiveness, and how it has an overall negative impact on psychological safety and people's work experience. Whether universities, multinational corporations, governmental organizations, hospitals, nonprofits, small or medium-sized businesses, the issues seem pervasive everywhere. And probably it's something that you would recognize as well. Perhaps our current cultural moment with heated conversations on critical justice concerns, vaccine mandates, COVID responses, and numerous political battles has added extra layers of division and infighting that further impact our ability or perhaps lack of ability for collaboration and respectful and productive conversations. A few weeks ago, I read a fascinating article by psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman in The Atlantic. What collective narcissism does to society. In the piece, Scott gives an insightful introduction to how collective narcissism can hinder groups and people from listening to each other or even fuel violence. Scott's article was based on research by Agnieszka Golek de Zavala, a professor at SWPS University in Warsaw, Poland, and a lecturer at Goldsmiths University in London. Agnieszka is the head of the Prejudice Lab. She defines collective narcissism as a belief that the exaggerated greatness of one's group is not sufficiently recognized by others. It's not just pride over the group you belong to, which can be really healthy, but a resentment against other groups. Her research has focused on what makes people prejudiced and what makes them fight in conflicts. Agnieszka has developed the collective narcissism scale, a model to measure the severity of group narcissistic beliefs that includes statements like, "My group deserves special treatment." I reached out to Agnieszka for you and for all of us to understand more of how collective narcissism fuels the conflict we see in the world today and perhaps even within our organizations. Being a native of Poland, Agnieszka has seen both how a country can come together peacefully, like in Poland's successful transition from communism, and how it can move or turn towards authoritarianism and conspiracy theories. It turns out that collective narcissism is a helpful predictor of both. So without further ado, let's jump into my fascinating conversation with Agnieszka Golek de Zavala. Agnieszka, it's really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Tobias. Thank you so much for inviting me, and the privilege is really mine. It is seriously honor and privilege for the scientists to be asked questions about their research and have this feeling that their research is relevant to people. So I'm really glad and I'm really happy to be here.
I'm so glad that you said yes. And as I told you before our interview, I read about your work in an article in The Atlantic. And as soon as I finished the article, I was just thinking, oh, I have to talk to Agnieszka, and I sent you an email, and I was so happy that you wanted to be on. And I just wanted to to ask you to help us get that definition of collective narcissism and what differentiates it from having a healthy group identity or healthy group pride.
Collective narcissism is an evaluative belief about a group. So people can have this belief about any group they belong to. We very often research it with reference to national group, but from very early on, we also research ethnic collective narcissism or collective narcissism with reference to university. So actually, the first time we used collective narcissism scale to test its psychometric functioning, no, whether it was a good scale or not, we first asked people, read the items of this scale first and tell us whether there is any group in your life to which you think those items apply. And people were giving us such groups like nation, ethnicity, gender, but also professional groups, also social class. So people can apply this belief into too many groups. And the belief is that the group is exceptional and unique, but not sufficiently recognized by others. So there is a resentment in this. Just one thing, that this is not a neutral belief. It's evaluative, right? It claims the greatness of the group, but also is resentful for the lack of the recognition of the group. And as I said, it can be applied to any group. And we also have studies in which you applied this belief, in which people actually can apply this belief to groups that they just form during the role-playing game, when they imagine that they are members of the make-believe nation.
And I'm thinking that aspect of it that you just said, that is, I mean, if we think about, so when can this potentially become destructive in that sense, or that the outcome can become destructive? And I guess that's connected to that belief or that sense of resentment.
I think so. I think, but there's also another aspect of that belief that others do not appreciate you sufficiently. It is that you are sort of motivated to monitor all the time whether the signs of appreciation are sufficient, whether they come or they come or they don't come, or you're motivated to monitor all the time whether others acknowledge your group's greatness, or they do something that can be interpreted as challenge and threat. And for collective narcissists, it actually a lot can be interpreted as challenge and threat. Even situations that would require some stretch of imagination to be interpreted as threatening, or situation in which a person did not mean to offend a group, for example, but that is happening and taken out of proportion by people who are high on collective narcissism. So definitely this hypersensitivity to threat and a tendency to interpret others as always harboring hostile intentions towards my own group, that's destructive.
And I'm thinking about this, that, I mean, one of the reasons why I really felt that I wanted to talk to you is because I think when we think about organizational culture, and then of course now we talk a lot about things in a broader perspective, but we also mentioned universities, and you mentioned that it can apply to any group. But I think when we talk about building organizational culture, building a healthy culture, I think we deal a lot with different tensions. And we could take, so using narcissism, I think I've had a conversation on this podcast with Professor Jennifer Chatman around narcissism, and where she talks, and now this is of course individual narcissism, but where she talked about, and her research has shown how organizations often kind of we see narcissists as visionary leaders, and we don't kind of divide between what is like what becomes destructive and what is something that we might need in an entrepreneurial organization, and that has a lot of consequences on the culture. But if we think about collective narcissism. I think about this aspect of this tension in organizations between that we want to create a sense of group identity. I mean, we want to be a group that come together around a shared mission or shared vision. But at the same time, of course, it's very important that we don't become sectarian. And it's very important, I think, that our identity is not built around resentment of others, resentment of other organizations or other or whatever that is, or if we would look even internally within an organization. So I'm thinking that about that tension between an identity and a pride and a connection with a shared mission that doesn't become sectarian in that sense.
So, you know, I recently wrote a paper that I called it Collective Narcissism, the Ugly and the Bad and the Ugly, because I really failed to see any potential or constructive only constructive potential of collective narcissism. But I must say now that I would not say that anymore. So I see there is a certain a line of research that I'm following and that I'm involved in that looks at mobilization potential of collective narcissism. So this is definitely, this is why I told you, this is an emotionally laden variable. That means that it is engaging and it mobilizes people to protect their group, especially when they think that there is an unfairness and injury happening to this group. And it is easier to mobilize people than to act on behalf of that group. So when you make people believe that their group is wronged, then you will energize people sort of developing that belief and forcefully sort of putting the narcissistic belief as something that should define a group now. And you will mobilize the group to action. The problem with it can be an action that changes the situation, which might be good because maybe the intergroup context is something that is toxic. Maybe you have inherent inequalities. And therefore, you mobilize the group that is disadvantaged to action, and the group acts and changes the organization for better, for more equal. The problem with collective narcissism is that, you know, some animals, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, would be the motto. So it once you unleash collective narcissism, it would be difficult to stop. And, you know, I mentioned in the beginning that I come from Poland and this is where the peaceful revolution happened. But this peaceful revolution had it very, very clearly articulated that they cannot allow that sort of narcissistic dynamic to happen, that they cannot allow hatred to happen, contempt to happen and take over. So, you know, all of these negative emotions are mobilizing, but they have to be put in check because they can bring more destruction than constructive change. And this tension is absolutely very important, the one that you talked about, that you have a constructive pride and the narcissistic pride of a group.
I think that is so, so fascinating and so important, and how you talk about how they were intentional about making sure. And I'm thinking that we could probably apply a bit of a similar lens on what happened with Nelson Mandela in South Africa and kind of that and that process there. And I'm thinking about so if we apply this again to an organizational context and if we think about something that is a lot less traumatic than what Poland and South Africa went through, but we think about something that is very common in organizational life, which is a merger or a takeover or a company acquires other companies and they have, of course, their group identities and they have their beliefs and so on. And one of the most common problems that we hear and see in organizations and that people bring up in organizations is this kind of us versus them mentality, that we have maybe it is a company that is put together through mergers, maybe it is companies that have been acquired, or maybe it's just different departments in different locations with different identities, and where there are a bit of a different, I would say, stories, and where maybe one group might feel that, oh, but this other group, they have been kind of promoted above us, or they're, we are being mistreated, or whatever. And as I was thinking and reading about collective narcissism, I was thinking that perhaps we can see some of that even in those type of settings, where it also then has destructive implications. And one, I guess I wanted to just test that theory with you, and another to just think about, so what are things that we can do to be intentional in the way that you said that they were in Poland, in terms of avoiding collective narcissism?
It's really difficult to strike the right balance, because I feel unfairly treated in whatever context that is. It can be an organization. Obviously, my voice can be heard when others also feel unfairly treated. So instead of advancing my own cause, I can find others and say, actually, this isn't my own cause. We all agree that this is something that is happening to us as a group. And that is, as I said, energizing. Now, making that normative context of that absolutely silent is very important. So when you look at all of the peaceful changes that took place all over the world, and some of them are more known than others, but they always had the same thing in common. What is the desirable course of action? So very, very clearly, we not offend each other. We do not have each other in contempt. We disagree. And that's a completely different thing than hating, right? But I think the other thing that is also important is that the salience, as we call it, of superordinate group, no? So within organizations, I suppose, so you just talked about the situation of merger. In this situation, it is absolutely the most important thing probably to build in both teams the sense that they belong to a superordinate category of the new merger, because that and this group has rules or ways of conduct that articulate very clearly that the values are this of respect and harmony, and not undermining each other, not having each other in contempt. No, so someone who doesn't agree with you still contributes to the betterment of the bigger whole, because by hearing the critical voices, we are all striving to improve that common identity. And that is very very well articulated in the conflict literature, that striving for the superordinate identity is something very important. And one of the very well documented strategy is called intergroup contact. So basically, this is as old as I think social psychology, proposed by Gordon Allport in the 50s, the proposition that in order to build a harmonious whole, you make sure that the parts of subordinate groups within this organization meet in the positive context in which they collaborate, and the goal of collaborating for the common identity is make very clear. So they hear and respect each other, and those rules are always repeated, respected, and rewarded. So they allow people to really express their differences, feeling safe, because the overarching goal is to solve them for the betterment of the larger whole within which the superordinate groups are nested. So sometimes it is good to actually, you know, motivate the group that feels disadvantaged to express their interests, but not motivated too much. So the expressing of the interest becomes hating the ones who dominate us. And that is something that very often destroys organizations, because the group that is possibly more stronger is seen as an enemy. And, you know, then those emotions that you can feel towards enemy, you mentioned black and white perception, but there is also certain emotionality involved here. As soon as you see them as black, that means evil, then you also dehumanize them, right? Because evil people are not really that much part of the humanity. Therefore, all of these negative emotions like hatred and contempt can happen towards them. So it is important for the dominant group to listen, so they are not conceptualized as this vicious enemy by those who consider themselves disadvantaged. And then building that feeling that they both belong to some common whole, bigger group, for which better mandate should work together. This is like the advice that would come from social psychology to any companies that struggle with internal harmony between the groups that are nested within it. You know that there's a lot of research that shows that people need groups. People need to have social identities, and they need to have many of them. So it's not just one that has to take over everything. So you can be a member of a nested group within an organization, and you feel like this is unique. This is a very specific identity with this particular people in your team. You feel embedded there and grounded, but you don't lose the sight of the fact that you are also embedded in a differently understood community. But the word community here is very important, because towards communities, we have positive feelings. Towards communities, we have responsibilities. Well, as soon as we start treating them not as communities that are composed of individual people with whom we have relations, who accept us and so on, we start essentializing groups. So when we essentialize groups, we start treating them as if they were one whole, you know, like members of the groups were not different from each other. And we start seeing groups as if they were individuals. And this is very often also happening, or it's a precondition to conflict. This is how our conflicts start escalating, that we start treating groups as individuals, and all of the individuals are exactly the same and the carriers of the same features that are usually negative. And this is how the black and white perception starts. But groups are very good for people to be in. They actually support well-being, and they support positive self-esteem. So this is called the social identity as a cure model. And there's a lot of research that shows that people need this positive embedment.
We should not try to break down group identities. And I guess that that's also something that maybe too easily we do, and we say, okay, now we're just together a part of this bigger organization. Now we should forget everything about what we were before, but that it might be that we can actually have multiple group identities and that we can flourish in that. And I think another aspect is, I think that too often we have not been giving people that really opportunities to collaborate between groups, like you've said before. And I think a third issue is that perhaps too many times we have leaders, and they might be senior leaders, they might be middle managers, who are taking the resentment route, in a sense, who are actively communicating the resentment to their teams, which I think then kind of fans the flame of collective narcissism within the group.
I think this is definitely an easier route. It happens faster, and in the beginning brings you effects. So you have the more cohesive groups, you have groups that are more mobilized, just the emotionality within those groups is negative. So I think in the longer run, this is not good. It doesn't really contribute to the small group you are a leader of or the larger organization. So basically, the collective narcissism literature is the warning as that it's very easy to start down this route. It's very difficult to stop once you start it.
What are some of the perhaps the examples that you see of the effects? And just we could take something, some quick example that you see of how collective narcissism is playing out in the world today.
There's a lot of research that shows that collective narcissism is related to a lack of solidarity with others in the pandemic, for example. So collective narcissism is related to the not following the rules that would make you and the others around you safe from the virus, which means also that for collective narcissism, it's not the community that is important. It's not the being embedded. It's the group image. And that's it. And as I said earlier, collective narcissists, they also do not really care of the reality that much. They don't care to understand how things work. They only care to know to which group they belong and who the by as members of this group, who they need to scapegoat, right? Who can they be aggressive towards? I said that they work as, are best described as aggressive conformists. So this also accounts for the very visible link between collective narcissism and conspiratorial thinking and believing in fake news, especially in pandemic that became very, very visible. But this is something that we noticed, you know, when Donald Trump was elected the president, we wrote a paper in which we showed that as his campaign developed, so grew the link between collective narcissism and conspiratorial thinking. The tendency to believe in all of those stories that had nothing to do with reality, but everything to do with identity building. So that's how I see this collective narcissism playing out. In internationally, in Poland, it plays out pretty ugly as well. So it is national collective narcissism is related to rejection of refugees that and a construal of refugees as dangerous and hostile, which has nothing to do with reality. But the reality is that we have a political party that is supported by people who score high on national collective narcissism. And this party is effectively killing helpless people on the Polish-Belarusian border. Just maybe 6 months ago, that played out differently. It played out as a rejection of the subgroups within the nation, rejection of sexual minorities and women. Because in Poland particularly, collective narcissism is related to Catholic narcissism in a very traditional way, so very patriarchal, so upholding very patriarchal values. So I must say that when I started studying collective narcissism, I thought about extremist groups, you know, like those groups that are sort of fringe. You have, let's say, nations in conflict, but only those extremists on the edges of the continuum would uphold collective narcissistic beliefs. Well, now it's mainstream. Now very many nations would vote for political parties that advanced narcissistic view of a nation.
So Agnieszka, thank you so much for taking the time. And just final thing, what is a way that people can connect with you and follow your work?
So I had a group that is called Prejudice Lab, and we exist within University of London at Goldsmiths. So either through the university website or our Prejudice Lab on Twitter or Facebook, or we are also, you can check our work on the website called collectivenarcissism.com.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.